May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. John Spadaro for the appellant, Marianne Sammons. I apologize to counsel for my typical display of eagerness. The question on this appeal, Your Honors, is one of statutory construction. That is the meaning of the term claimant as it appears in 21 Delaware Code Section 2118B and more particularly subsection C of that statute. And with the court's indulgence, I'd like to touch upon those parts of the statutory text very briefly that lie at the heart of the PIP scheme, including Section 2118B itself, but starting at the beginning, logically, with the PIP statute proper, Section 2118. Section 2118, and specifically Subdivision A, says that if you're the owner of a motor vehicle registered in Delaware, then you must secure for that vehicle insurance coverage providing certain compensation. And it goes on to list liability insurance, it goes on to list PIP. With respect to PIP, in subsection A2A, and I won't quote at any great length, but it begins this way, quote, compensation, and this is what the insurance must provide, again, compensation to injured persons for reasonable and necessary expenses incurred within 2 years from the date of the accident for, and then it goes on to list medical expenses, lost earnings, funeral expenses, the component parts of PIP coverage. The reference there, of course, is to injured persons, not to care providers or any other constituency. So at the starting point, the PIP statute exists to ensure that people will act in a financially responsible way for the benefit of this constituency, injured persons. Turning to 2118B, well, subsection A of 2118B is very useful indeed as a guidepost, because here the legislature expressly tells us why they're enacting the statute. It says the purpose of this section is, and I'll quote again, to ensure reasonably prompt processing and payment of sums owed by insurers to their policyholders and other persons covered by their policies. And then it goes on to say, pursuant to the PIP statute, policyholders and other persons covered by their policies. Now, we confronted the argument below, initially, from Hartford, that this reference to other persons was a reference to care providers. Obviously, it reads other persons covered by the policies, which excludes care providers, and Hartford has since abandoned that argument. But the purpose of the statute overall is about as meaningful a guidepost for purposes of statutory construction as you can have, and here's the General Assembly telling us what the purpose is. The constituency to be protected is the policyholder and other persons covered by their policies. Subsection B is the first place where you see the word claimant in the statute. And I won't read from it verbatim, but it's the familiar requirement that when an insurance company, a PIP insurer, receives notice of a PIP claim, it has a certain amount of time in which to forward a PIP application to the claimant. And that's the word used in subsection B in connection with this requirement, that you must send a PIP application, an application for benefits, within so many days of receiving notice to the claimant. And not even Hartford argues that PIP applications in Delaware are mailed to care providers. And we've shown the court, both from internet sources and from more direct sources, that the PIP applications would make no sense if sent to care providers. They ask,
Mr. Spadaro, the real world on the ground reality is that medical providers are submitting claims directly to insurance carriers. Probably, 99.999% of the time? Is that what's happening in the real world?
Well, increasingly that percentage is dropping, Your Honor, because increasingly, especially with larger medical practices, they're actually hiring third-party billing vendors who are patched into their software, so that when the doctor's clerical people type in somebody visited today and here's the CPT code that tells you what the procedure was and here's the cost, it's automatically received on a computer screen by the billing vendor, and it's the billing vendor increasingly, not in most cases, but increasingly, because outsourcing is what it is, and the economics of it are.
If I understand this record, or if I'm just am confused, I read somewhere in the record that in this very case, your client executed an assignment that said the healthcare provider could be paid directly. Is that correct? Let's take it one step at a time.
Yes. There's secondary evidence of that. The assignment itself, I don't think, is something the court has seen, nor have I.
But that's not in dispute.
That's not in dispute. I'd be amazed if, consistent with Justice Ridge's question, I'd be amazed if it wasn't done that way.
So, Your Honor. Just indulge me for a moment.
Sure, of course.
So your client says, signed something.
Yes.
That did something that said to the Hartford, you can pay my health care provider directly. And then, as I understand the secondary dispute and your argument, it is, and well, we said you could pay the medical benefits directly, and but this interest we're claiming is not a medical benefit, and therefore it's not precluded by our assignment of being paid to us. Is that correct?
That is correct. It refers to, the secondary evidence refers to, quote, payment of medical benefits, and here, with the court's permission, I'll insert ellipses, payment of medical benefits for services described below. And we point out that, in the first instance, statutory interest is not a medical benefit, and statutory interest is not incurred for medical services. It's incurred on account of insurance company misconduct.
Right, so my question to you then, going back to your discussion of claimant in the statute, is once you make this assignment of medical benefits to the health care provider, why doesn't the health care provider become the claimant for all purposes, including interest?
Well, because...
And your answer seems to be simply because that's not what was assigned.
Exactly. And I ask Your Honors, it's sometimes difficult to do this in a consumer context, but try to imagine how this court would react if we had two large institutional commercial giants arguing about the language of assignment. People would care. Lawyers and jurists would care about the actual language of the assignment. And this is a jurisdiction, this is a fairly iron-bound, plain-meaning jurisdiction in terms of contract construction. The doctor has the power of the pen, and the doctor decides how the assignment will read. And there's a case, actually, Spine Care Delaware versus State Farm, that I prosecuted before Judge Babiarz, before his retirement, in which case I argued that the care provider could sue directly, for not just for PIP benefits, but for punitive damages and statutory interest, because of the specific language and the breadth of the assignment in that case. And that issue had to be litigated, and Judge Babiarz had to read the assignment and parse through the language, and that, as I recall...
I understand that,
yeah.
But whether it's statutory construction or contract interpretation, we still try to come up with something that makes sense or is logical. And so in this particular case, as I understand it, the interest was actually paid to the health care provider. But we'll put that aside.
Yes.
But your argument is, you paid my health care provider in an untimely way, and therefore I'm entitled to interest on your late payment to my health care provider.
Yes, Your Honor.
And why doesn't it make sense to simply say that the health care provider is entitled to the interest?
Well, first I'd say that's a policy question, which has already been decided by the General Assembly when they said that the statutory interest will go to the claimant in a statute where claimant, in our view, logically only means one thing, the injured person. And the purpose in the prefatory language, in the preamble, is to protect the interests of the claimant.
But let me stop you right there, because that strikes me as a pretty important feature here. If the purpose of having this statutory interest requirement is to protect the claimant, and the claimant is the policyholder, the insured, the injured party, right, then how is paying interest to a claimant consistent with that purpose when the claimant hasn't suffered in any way by whatever the late payment might have been?
Well, here's, Your Honors, where I want to invoke the concept that Justice Ridley talked about, the real world. I respectfully disagree that when you're entitled to some insurance benefit in the form of payment of medical expenses, and they don't pay your doctor on time, that you suffer no harm. You suffer harm and a risk of harm in many different ways. You could have tensions arise in the relationship between doctor and patient. There are, in the workers' compensation context and in PIP cases, many cases where doctors say, I can't see you anymore. I'm not getting paid on time, so I'm just not going to see you anymore. You have a debt.
Well, wait a second. I thought this all starts in the real world, where the injured party goes to a health care provider and says, I've got a broken arm, you know, please take care of it. And while they're checking in, the health care provider says, do you have insurance coverage? And they say, yeah, this is my policy. And they say, please assign us the right to recover from your insurance company, and I sign it off. At that point, what am I at risk for? If the healthcare provider is not happy with my insurance company, can't the healthcare provider say, well, I'm going to need you to pay me up front, and then you collect from the health, from the insurance company, because we're not going to deal with them? Couldn't they do that?
Well, in terms of, as a theoretically they could, but in terms of real world practicalities, they're not going to have much of a practice if they're only going to render services with advance payment because of the staggering cost of health care. A lot of people can't afford to make payment up front.
Okay, well then let's twist it around. If the health care provider is going to take on the responsibility, if you will, of being paid by the insurance company, and if the insurance company, for whatever reason, is stalling on making those payments, isn't the healthcare provider in a position more akin to the insurance company to basically seek relief for that failure to pay in a prompt fashion, whereas the claimant is not?
Against the insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying, yeah, well-heeled doctors are in a better position to do that. In the real world, though, if you read these assignments, typically they'll say, you assign me the rights, but you retain the responsibility. And it's not simply, you know, please will you sign this. If you don't sign it, you're not going to get treated. You've got to sign it, you're not going to get treated.
But okay, in terms of you retain the responsibility, real world, at least what I understand, you sign the document, the health provider tries to get recovery from the insurance company. At some point, probably several months later, if for whatever reason the insurance company doesn't pay all of it or any of it, then it comes back and says, okay, we tried your health insurance company, they didn't pay, now you owe us. Why is that not the resolution, if you will, of the problem of, well, we have our credit rating at risk, or we have our ability to do business with these doctors at risk, when in fact the doctor will just come back and say, okay, we didn't get payment, now you're responsible for the payment, and at which point it now kind of goes back into the mode where the claimant has a cause of action against the insurance company for not paying the bill.
Well, I think I'm not sure that we're disagreeing, Your Honor. And that, as a practical matter, that's what happened. I represent people all the time who are being done by bill collectors and credit agencies because doctors weren't paid, even though they gave the doctors the assignment,
right,
even though the doctors have the financial wherewithal to sue. Doctors don't want to be forever suing insurance companies, and they generally don't like dealing with insurance companies. So what they'll do is they will impair, and I don't blame them. They need to get paid. They will impair their patients' credit ratings, or they will cut the patient off. And these are the types of harm that actually befall the patient. So who should get the statutory interest? It's not at all anomalous that the General Assembly said the statutory interest and the benefits are owed to the claimant, even though in the real world assignments are the norm.
Well, if you have, if it's conceded in this case that your client signed a document that authorized the insurer to pay the medical provider directly, and you've got this issue, well, does that mean the bill plus interest or the bill, but I'm going to keep the right to statutory interest myself? Who has the burden of producing that information at this point? Is it your client on summary judgment, or however this would be labeled as this motion practice? Your client, who is more likely to be able to demonstrate that I reserved this right to keep the interest, or is it the insurer I mean, who should produce that evidence, which apparently hasn't been produced?
Well, Your Honor, I would take the burden on of producing it. There was a motion to stay discovery below, and discovery was stayed. And all we have as a result is the secondary evidence. So we don't really know what the assignment says. But we know the second, and that's why we seek a remand. We really haven't had an opportunity to go and get the assignment through the course of discovery. The assignment is not part of Mrs. Salmon's medical records as such. It's a billing record. So typically a HIPAA release, I'm sorry.
Approving a reservation of the right to collect statutory interest is on your client? Did I hear you correctly?
If there's an assignment, I think it falls upon us to say, well, here's the assignment, which we have to secure through discovery, because we can't get it generally through medical authorization. We haven't had the opportunity for discovery because of their motion to stay discovery, and they had a right to file such a motion. The case should be remanded for us to get the assignment, show it to the court, and say, look, Mrs. Simmons did not assign the right to statutory interest. She only assigned the right to benefits. But if we had to make the decision based on the record here, the secondary evidence, as framed by Hartford in its document, says benefits for medical services rendered. Statutory interest, I don't think, you torture the concept of statutory interest in the statute to call it a medical benefit rendered for services, incurred for services rendered.
So if I understand, your position is, as a general rule, every claimant has retained the right to get statutory interest because the standard, if you will, assignment says, I assign my right to receive payment for these medical services to you, the medical provider. And it doesn't say, except I'm withholding and retaining the right to sue for interest.
Well, Your Honor, I think we want to be careful about making assumptions about real-world facts like that without having a base of data. Because there are some doctors who draft these.
Well, wait a second. Does your complaint say, I, on behalf of the class, I'm someone who assigned my rights but retained the right to interest?
No.
In the assignment?
No, Your Honor. And
it doesn't make that allegation.
It doesn't allege that with particularity because there's no heightened pleading standard that applies to those claims, to the claims for breach of contract and bad faith breach of contract. And we didn't anticipate that this would be an issue. I've litigated, prosecuted, and settled about a half dozen of these in Delaware on behalf of injured persons and classes of tens of thousands of injured persons. A $5 million settlement in the Crowhorn case with a class of almost 30, and the issue has not come up. So, no, we did not have the foresight to anticipate that they would make this we didn't anticipate that they'd initially argue that other person covered under their policies means a care provider. But it's a simple matter to amend a complaint. I don't think a pleading issue is really the problem here. The problem is, in the real world, if the plaintiff's bar were here at my side, if the medical legal community were here at my side, they'd tell you there are no doctors who can sue directly for PIP benefits absent assignment. There are no doctors who are pursuing insurance commissioner arbitrations for PIP benefits absent an assignment. The doctors don't have those rights absent assignment. And if I could drag my first year contract professor into the courtroom with me, he's, God rest his soul, Professor Calamari would tell us, well, the assignment can only be read as broadly as it's written. And some of these assignments are very narrow and say you're just going to get insurance proceeds or benefits, and some of them are much broader. And it depends really on the business acumen and the draftsmanship of whoever does the work for the doctor in the first instance. But I hope I've answered your questions.
We've used up some of the time you reserved, but you'll still have 3 minutes left for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. It's a privilege on my part to be here. Your Honors, I guess let me start. Much of the discussion centered on what the facts were or might be in the real world, and I just want to confirm what's in the record before you and the facts in this case. There were 24 requests for payment that were submitted by or in the conjunction with the Salmon's claim for PIP benefits. Of those 24, four claims were submitted by Mrs. Salmon's or Mr. Salmon's for things like lost wages, replacement of eyeglasses. The other 20 were submitted by medical providers, and each form from those medical providers is in the record before you, and each form says that Mrs. Sammons has assigned to that medical provider the right to receive payment from the Hartford. The record is undisputed that in each of those 20 instances, the Hartford received the claim form from the medical provider and made payment to the medical provider. The record is also undisputed that the plaintiffs never paid or were at risk of having to pay any of the medical bills. Each of the bills was paid in full by the Hartford. 20 or 19 of those bills were paid within the 30 days. There was one bill as to which there was a question whether it was paid within the 30 days or not. The Hartford's records indicated it was paid the day after the claim form was submitted. There was a factual question as to what Hartford showed as the first claim form was, in fact, the second request for payment of that bill. And as a result, $2.70 worth of interest was at least potentially due to that medical provider, and it was paid by Hartford to that medical provider
what
when that became clear.
What about the four claims that were directly from the Sammons?
They were paid directly to the Sammons.
In a timely fashion?
In a timely fashion. No dispute about that.
What if another insurance company, not yours because you're very responsible, but if another insurance company made it a habit that any time they saw a bill coming in from a health care provider under an assignment as opposed to coming in directly from the claimant, they put it in a different pile. So if we get bills from the claimant, we know we'd be in trouble if we don't pay them within the 30 days under the statute. But we've got all these bills from the providers, you know, hold them up even just 30 more days, and over time and across the board, that could make a significant difference. Should the providers be allowed to say, wait a second, you can't do that to us either?
Yes, that is exactly what we're saying, and that's what Judge Stokes found. What Judge Stokes said is, and I'll just use the facts of this case, for the four claims that were submitted by the Sammons for payment and were paid to the Sammons, they were the claimant for purposes of those four claims, and they would be entitled to interest if those claims had been paid late. For the 20 claims,
and that's as a matter of law, no matter what the assignment says or does not say?
Because the claims submitted by the Sammons were not assigned to anyone. They were for benefits directly.
That. For the providers.
For the providers, Your Honor, I think the answer to your question is in the text of the statute itself. If you look at, and Mr. Spadaro didn't get to Section C, which is the only section that's at issue before us, if you look at the language of that section, it says that the insurer shall make payment to the claimant, and if the payment is not made within 30 days of receipt of the claim form and the supporting documentation, then the amount due to the claimant and to be paid to the claimant is automatically increased by interest at the rate that's set forth in the statute.
So does that mean that, as a matter of law, let's assume hypothetically Mr. Spadaro's best factual scenario is that his client's assignment says, I assigned you the right to collect medical payments, but reserve unto myself the right to collect statutory interest. That would be invalid as a matter of law?
My reading of the statute, Your Honor, is that would not be proper, that the claimant, under the terms of the statute, regardless of what the assignment says in terms of reserving rights, the claimant for purposes of this is the entity that is submitting the claim for payment. There's no question that Mrs. Sammons intended that the medical provider would submit the claim and would receive payment directly. And in that circumstance, Judge Stokes found, both because of the language of Section C and because of the simple common sense notion to which the court alluded, since Mrs. Sammons hadn't paid the bill, hadn't received any payment late, since the medical provider was receiving payment directly from the insurance company and was the entity that allegedly received late payment, it's the medical provider that is intended by the legislature to get the interest on that payment.
No matter what the written assignment may or may not say?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, on the particular facts of this assignment, the actual claim form is in the record before you. It's B-148 in the appendix to our brief. And that claim form says, I authorize my medical provider to submit this claim for benefits and to receive payment.
And where are you referring to? I have a copy of it.
Yes, it's there's a box. I apologize, Your Honor, but my eyes are not as young as they used to be. It's about halfway down on the right-hand side. It's box, I think, 15. It says insured's authorization. Do you see that? Right beneath...
I think I see it.
Okay. Yes, I think we're suffering from the same problem. But there is... It says insured or authorized person's signature. I authorize payment of medical benefits to the physician for...
Undersigned.
Yes, physician. Exactly.
So do I understand you to be saying that you would be content with a decision of this court that said that as a matter of law, claimant for purposes of the PIP statute is whoever submits a claim, whether it's the injured party, the insured, or the health care provider, and that all health care providers can take get the benefit of this statutory provision anytime any insurer makes a late payment to a health care provider, the statutory penalties, if you will, kick in.
Yes, that's exactly what Judge Stokes found. I think that's a correct statement of the law, and that's, in fact, the way it operates. I mean, when Hartford determined that there was a late payment, it paid the interest to the medical provider, and that's exactly what we think is the right outcome in this case. And it,
what is it about health care providers that the legislation indicates a need to protect them?
It's not to protect them, Your Honor. The purpose of the interest is clearly established. It is intended to incent the insurers to pay within 30 days. And the longer they delay, the greater the rate of interest under the statute. But the incentive...
But there's a reason why there's an incentive to pay within 30 days, isn't there? And isn't that reason in order to promptly compensate the injured parties?
That is the purpose that is set forth in A. That's correct, Your Honor. In 2118
BA. So how is that purpose accomplished if health care providers are now the ones that are getting the benefit of this protection as opposed to insured injured parties?
The claimant is still, or the injured party is still getting the benefit of a prompt payment to his or her doctor for the reasons that were identified earlier. If the doctor doesn't get paid, there may be issues that revert back to the injured party. But what the system is intended to do is to ensure that when an insurer receives a request for payment, it makes that payment in a timely fashion. And in the circumstances of Mrs. Salmon's claim, she wanted certain payments made to herself, and she authorized that certain payments would be made to the medical providers. Her interest is the same.
Right. Okay. So if somebody were able to do a survey, we would find out that insurance companies typically are paying the statutory interest anytime they're late to health care providers.
I believe you would find that to be the case. I know that to be the case for the Hartford. I can't speak for other carriers. And that is exactly what the record is before the court in this instance.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. It's always of dubious worth to argue anecdotal evidence, but if we had the benefit of that survey here in Delaware, I believe we would find, based on what I've been told by plaintiff's lawyers who said, well, because you had this case against State Farm, one of my clients just got a check, spontaneously without asking for it, for $2.18 or $6. Those checks, in my experience, are being sent directly by Delaware Auto Insurers to claimants. But the providers, in any event, are not, they have really no interest in pursuing $2 claims or $200 claims. And I've seen statutory interest in these cases range anywhere from less than a dollar to up to $1,500 or more.
Well, by the same token, your client individually has very little interest in pursuing a claim for $2.74.
It's true enough that no one does.
Right, but so that's why it's a class action.
Yes.
But why shouldn't it be a class action on behalf of all health care providers?
Because the amount that an individual provider, if they aggregate a provider has two doctors in the office and aggregates all these claims, will probably still not be enough to incentivize.
Right. So why not have if your interpretation is, or if their interpretation is correct, why not just bring a class action on behalf of all healthcare providers?
The incentive, I mean, that has been done and can be done, but typically in these cases, it's ordinary folks, because the incentive awards that come out of these cases when they're successful, $3,000, $5,000, $10,000, make a difference to ordinary people, whereas a $3,000 or $5,000 incentive award might not make such a difference to a care provider. So they're less likely to sign up for this kind of duty. And all the Delaware cases in this area, as I said before, Crowhorn, Womack against State Farm, the Kerr case against American Independent, the Cutler case against Progressive, have all been prosecuted on behalf of ordinary people and not on behalf of care providers.
But they were prosecuted for payments that weren't made in a timely fashion to those people, correct?
Those were prosecuted for medical bills and lost wages, not just lost wage claims.
Right, but what I'm saying is that those other claims, at least as you put in your brief, those other claims, the class plaintiffs were individuals who were seeking recovery because as individuals, they had not received timely payment of their bills.
Yes, Your Honor, but it's no different here. I mean, I don't think we can imagine or realistically posit that none of these tens of thousands of persons in these other Delaware cases have signed assignments. We all have. And Justice Rigsley is right that 99% of the time those assignments are executed. So it's really conceptually no different from what we have here. But I do want to point out, I think there was some language left out. I didn't get to subsection C, and I apologize for that. Subsection C does not just talk about amounts due to the claimant. Subsection C makes two references to amount of claimed benefits that are due to the claimant, and then again, the amount of unpaid benefits due from the insurer to the claimant. Read in context, and people can disagree or disagree, but your honors can read that as well as I can. Claimed benefits due to the claimant are insurance proceeds due to the party to the insurance contract, and that means to the injured person. Subsection D creates a private right of action.
Mr. Spadaro?
Yes, Your Honor.
I think we're going to have to stop with C. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
And thank you both for your arguments. And the court will take this matter under advisement and take a brief recess.
Thank you, Your Honor.